the woman on my lap and she's drinking champagne. Have white skin, got a satin eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire sky. Well-dressed man, waiting on the last plane. Standing in the gallows, with my head in the news. It is now, I'm expecting all hell to break loose. Crazy and time is strange. But tonight I'm out of range. I used to care, but in the chain.
60 seconds could be an eternity. Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Here we go. Today's date is the 12th of November, 2018. It's a Monday. And you're tuned in to the Micro Effect. To get back to our lesson on Lawrence of Arabia, I know that President Trump was over in Europe celebrating the 100th anniversary of the end of World War One yesterday, 11/11. Interesting. Didn't even plan it. That's just the way it all turned out. We'll get back to that and some other things. Some things are in the work here at Liberty Tree Radio. Get some new broadcast time, and it'll be later in the day. We'll continue with this broadcast, but your mind is your primary weapon. Is going to expand out, or as it looks right now, it's still in the decision. Let's kick it around a little bit. Let's think about it. Some things to work out of having a different time. And then in addition to this broadcast here on Monday morning, but some of the things to work out is the time, not necessarily the time that the broadcast is going to be on, but trying to organize the time to do it. The second of all, another factor is the subject matter. Chances are to stick with the insurgency aspect of it, but there's other parts to think about. The next idea is the format. Now, I know here on Liberty Tree Radio, there's frequently people like to call in and give their observations, things, and generally that I don't take a lot of calls, and I'll just leave it at that. But I'm willing to, hear what the listeners have to say. The next is the contact things on the and the content of the communications ability of those aspects of it. And I'll just kind of leave it in that, just the general area of, and it kind of ties in with the subject matter and what's going to be covered. A part of it has to do with the logistics end of it, the collecting the information to present on Liberty Tree Radio. And lastly, but importantly, not necessarily that it just happens to be the last on the list, but it doesn't mean that it's less important or more important, but it has to do with the bill. The bill for 1 hour, one day a week on Liberty Tree Radio is $300. And right now, one person is footing the whole bill to bring this broadcast to you. And then if it expands out to another hour, that's going to be an additional $300. And I know part of it has to do with the bill that goes to pay the bandwidth for the end of the year bill, et cetera, that Liberty Tree Radio is broadcasting on. And then there's the additional charge to bring you these broadcasts, and they're not the same. One doesn't offset the other one. It's an addition to, not a subtraction from. And to tell you the truth, it's really not fair for one person to have to foot that bill. And like I say, these are some of the parts and pieces that needs to be put together. And I spoke with Edward this weekend and just discussing things just in general nature about the time, the content, the format, et cetera, that the amount of people that are listening and easily, if each person here we go again. Here's the windup and the pitch. Yeah, I understand. So if there's 50 people listening, each one would send $10 a year, not a month, not a day. So it's less than $1 a month. Maybe for your envelope and the money order and the stamp, maybe it'll come out to $12 a year. It'd pretty much take care of the whole bill for both hours. But as usual, it's that 5-15-80 rule. Five people make things happen. 15 people watch what 15% of the people watch what happens, and 80% of the people want to stand on the sidelines with a hand in their pocket and a finger in their nose and wonder what happened. But anyway, I'm not going to dwell on the money aspect of it. If you're getting benefits out of here, never mind. There was an interesting discussion on Friday's town hall meeting. Edward and I were discussing the aspect about news items on how things happen in one place, but they're not reported in that place, but they might get reported somewhere else, etc., etc. Fairly significant news items. I noticed it's almost that we've come in a complete circle, because now all we're doing a month or so ago, before all the hurricanes hit the East Coast and Florida and et cetera, and elections and things like that, that we were talking about the fires in California. And now look at this. My, Sergeant Carter. Now all of a sudden, what are we talking about now? Yeah. So and it ties in with part of our lesson today, and I need to be in that we have such a limited time, but I'd like to bring you one interesting, I wonder why they didn't report on that aspect of the news, and being that Edward's down in Texas, so you would think that a significant story like this might have at least made news in Texas. I guess technically it might have done, but there's this little town called Waco. Maybe you've heard about Waco, Texas, and the radio station or TV, doesn't say, it just gives the call sign, KWTX, Waco, Texas. Zeta's sentencing of Juan Francisco Kiko Trevino, 5 life terms, plus 20 years. Gee, a drug lord got sentenced to 5 life sentences. Yeah. If a drug lord gets sentenced to 5 life sentences, but a reporter wasn't there to report on it, did it make a noise? Waco, Texas, KWTX, that's Kilo Whiskey Tango X-Ray. A Mexican drug cartel leader was sentenced Thursday in Waco's federal court to 5 life prison terms plus 20 years after he was convicted here in July of possession with intent to distribute cocaine and conspiracy to interfere with commerce by extortion in a case that started with the discovery of large quantities of drugs during a raid in a local residential neighborhood. U.S. District Judge Alia Moses sentenced Juan Francisco Trevino Chavez, who's known as Kiko Trevino, 38 years old, to 2 life terms on counts 1 and 2, 3 life terms on counts 3, 4, 5, each plus 20 years on counts 6 and 7, ordered him to pay $4 million in fines and $800 in special assessment to the court. As she read the sentence, Moses reminded Trevino that he'd received no consideration in sentencing because he had refused to cooperate during the investigation. No cooperation, so no consideration, she said from the bench. And so when I spoke to Edward on Saturday morning, in reference to our discussion on the town hall meeting, he hadn't heard about it. So there's a prime example of when we talk about the compartmentalization in the news. you would think, oh, but they'll go, oh, well, but you see, you know, oh, El Chapo Guzman's trial's gonna, it's getting underway, and we didn't want to taint the jury pool, and we didn't want to, yeah, right. Oh, it's the poor people coming up through the convoy, so we didn't, oh, yeah, right. So anyway, I just wanted to bring you that little piece of information. A drug cartel leader gets sentenced to 5 life prison terms, and it doesn't even make a noise. Let's get everybody distracted with a forest fire in California. See? California. The fast-paced nature of this broadcast, that we don't always get time to flesh stuff out. A lot of times we're just hitting highlights. But one of the subjects that we've been covering here fairly extensively on Your Mind is Your Primary Weapon, not only on this broadcast on Liberty Tree Radio, but also have another broadcast over on The Micro Effect on Thursday and Friday, and we have 2 hours each day on that, so we can expand some of those things out. We've been covering a little bit about unconventional warfare and psychological warfare operations, and also about the human factors in undergrounds and insurgency, and those two lessons converged and rotated quite a bit of around psychological operations. Now, for used to the term psychological warfare, psy ops, and the new term that's been in for several years now is MISO, MISO. And as I recall, it means military information support operations. They don't call it Psy War anymore or Psy Ops anymore. I guess it's a little too harsh. So it's called MISO, M-I-S-O, and it's an accepted military abbreviation, M-I-S-O. And then there's also another expansion, but it hasn't become official yet, but they call it PPM, and that stands for Psy War, Psy Ops, and MISO. So they just abbreviate it, PPM. Now, over the years, at least for however long, oh, back at least in the Vietnam War era, 60s or so, you had, what was that, COINTELPRO. And people have been talking about it and complaining about it and describing it, about how they do it. Now, my aspect of it is, so we see that it's going on. The federal government has admitted that it's going on. There's quite a bit of information available on what it is and how it's done. So I'm just kind of wondering that, you know, it's almost like, you know, something unpleasant that everybody wants to dodge around. They like to talk about it. They'll describe it. But nobody's going to do anything about it. But once again, sometimes it seems like it's just, we can sit here and describe the dimensions of the septic tank. I don't need to know how thick the wall is or how big around the pipe was. I want to know how to get out of the septic tank. So I suggest, instead of complaining about PPM, why don't we study it? Why don't we turn it to our favor and our benefit? Isn't that part of the deal of about, you know, we can sit here and go, well, you know, oh, if we just get more people in this movement, then we could really make a change. And then everything just circulates around and circulates around and circulates around, and people complain about it and complain about it and complain about it. So I say we need to study these and then use it against them. Now, I brought it to your attention before, a fairly new book. Well, I think it was published back in January of 2018, so it's not even a year old. But it's a book written by Max Boot called The Road Not Taken, and that centers around Major General Edward Lansdale, who we've covered on the broadcasts before. And it's quite interesting in the study on what he did to help. Not necessarily people say about, well, you know, we can't interfere with other people's elections, and I agree with that. But then again, sometimes if post-World War II and trying to get the Philippines back on their feet and get things running in a proper direction again, but there was a lot of people that were in the corrupt previous government before the Japanese invaded. And then there were some of them that had actually collaborated with the Japanese, and I understand that aspect of it, you know. And so anyway, the notice that some of these people, especially the president of the Philippines, wanted to get back in as president of the Philippines, but not a lot of people liked the guy. And there were some pretty underhanded things like printing up 40,000 ballots that were located in a warehouse, and unfortunately the warehouse burnt down. And there were other things. So it's not necessarily that they were interfering per se exactly as to skew the election, but the United States was there to make sure that nobody cheated. It's like, you know, could just be the referee or so. And that's kind of ties in with something a little bit further up the road here when we talk about elections, especially what's going on here in the United States as to where, you know, if somebody loses a baseball game, they don't blame the referee. But it seems like, anyway, it's time to make that rough analogy to Major General Edward Lansdale was just being a referee and making sure that the law and the sanctity, if I can use that word, of the elections was fair and equal to all people, and also as it is. But anyway, that's an interesting study on the who, the what, the where, the why, the when. So for you that are interested in trying to figure out how we can get out of this mess, this septic tank that we're in, instead of complaining about the ambient temperature of the water and who built the septic tank and who financed the septic tank, because to tell you the truth, frankly, I've been hearing about certain groups of people for 20 years of who's to blame, but it doesn't really do any good. I guess, you know, I guess it helps identify who it is, but it doesn't get us out of the septic tank. And that's another observation I've made about the Patriot movement, that all they want to do is sit there and complain and blame certain groups or certain organizations and that aspect of it. It is okay. There's a certain extent of is actually identifying who got us here. But obviously we got it 20 years ago. So what's the use of talking about it over and over again? Kind of like sitting here in some circular. It's like there's a lot of activity. It's like riding a merry-go-round. Oh, it's going around and around. There's a lot of energy being expended, but you ain't going anywhere. Next subject. Yesterday, Veterans Day, 11/11. So I know that today there's a lot of Veterans Day parades going on. So for the veterans out there, my email address is altabib762@hotmail.com, and that's Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo Echo Bravo 762@hotmail.com. And thanks for tuning in today, and thank you for helping contribute to Liberty Tree Radio to keep it on the air. Freedom isn't free. And as always, we send this broadcast out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette, Robert Miner. Contact telephone number 701-251-2365. 701-251-2365. 6-5, and I'm not going to tell you about, you know, push this button, push that button. You figure it out. You've heard it for almost a year here on Liberty Tree Radio and the micro effect and multiple different angles on when bring up hard way and things like that and hear the broadcasts and stuff. Let's see what else. Oh, we've been, this kind of ties in with the expansion of your mind as your primary weapon. On the micro effect, we've been running what discuss as or describe as 72 articles. The observations and advice that I've seen over the years of trying to conduct operations on the southwest border. And now I'm in a dilemma of, after we wrap up our lesson of Lawrence of Arabia, of what are we going to do if we expand out, and when it's going to be. Is it going to be next week, or is it going to be after the first of the year? Well, a lot of that depends on the support that you get from the listeners. So in the past year, what's been going on when we expanded out in January here on to Liberty Tree Radio, the question was, is it going to be just an extension of the broadcast on the micro effect? And my observation was that since we are going to a different network, it could be exposing new people to these concepts of insurgency, about the education, the strategy, the tactics, the training, the leadership, the planning, the intelligence preparation of the battlefield, the financing, field sanitation, organization, security, communications, medical, after action review, and MISO, et cetera, just to touch a few aspects of it, not to mention the history and the examples of certain insurgent operations from around the world, mostly from post-World War II, but certainly older. I don't know how far we go back, 2,500 years, Alexander the Great. So the question was, is to run two separate broadcasts, and that's kind of where we did that, maintained our lesson on the micro effect, and then started over basically from square one for the benefit of the new listeners, and also to reinforce the lesson for the longtime listeners, kind of like, let's look at this. Let's go over here and re-examine it again and hone the points a little bit. And then somewhere along the way, in the middle of the year, then Jeffrey Bennett had some other issues that he needed to attend to and asked me to pick up his 2 hours. So then I'm juggling three different broadcasts, all generally on the same thing, but running at different times, different networks, and trying to bring other people up to speed. And that was difficult, to say the least. And so then the question is, so we got a couple of options here. Is one, to run two or three different broadcasts in Liberty Tree Radio and the micro effect, or to blend them all together. Now, that's that. So the contact information for Liberty Tree Radio, what is it, libertytreeradio.4mg.com, and the mailing address is there. I think that's Liberty Tree Radio, or I guess you could abbreviate it, LTR, P.O. Box 194, Dexter, Michigan, 48130. And the information is there. I guess if you go to the website, there's got the contact information and the PayPal or however that donate button works. And that part. Also, to be part of live on Liberty Tree Radio, you can dial 712-432-0900. 712-432-0900. And then the room number is 957-464, the pound sign, 957-464, and the pound sign. So if you'd like to today, I see we're down at the bottom, and so that means we only got 30 minutes left in today's broadcast. I'd really like to get back to our lesson of Lawrence of Arabia, the evolution of a revolt. Well, we might have music coming in here at the bottom of the hour. But if you'd like to join us today and put your 2 cents in of about the expansion of the broadcast here on Liberty Tree Radio and get your input as to the options. And one last thing is, I'm not going to dwell on it too much, but that's the whole point about joining together with the band. It's going to be up to you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. Don't go nowhere. Are you going to join together with the band, or are you going to stand on the sideline with your finger in your nose? Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. The choice is up to you. Are you going to stand on the sideline? Are you going to join together with the band? Your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 12th of November, 2018. It's a Monday, and you're tuned into Liberty Tree Radio, libertytreeradio.4mg.com. Telephone number is 712-432-0900. And then once you're there, the voice will come on. You don't have to wait until the message runs out. You can enter the numbers 957-464 and the pound sign. I find it odd, though, that, you know, there's a lot of this effort, especially yesterday being the 100th anniversary of the end of World War One, but several thousand miles away, there was also a part of World War One that was going on in the Middle East, and it fits in extremely well with our lesson on Lawrence of Arabia, and it also fits in well with our lesson on insurgency. Prime examples of the principles of insurgency, that the insurgents always have the upper hand. Now, oftentimes have been posed the question of about, well, isn't the government the insurgent? And even in, you know, dictatorships or things like that. And no, the simple answer is no, it's not. Because the insurgency is a war of the weak against the strong. So if the government is the strong one and it's oppressing the people is insurge, a Latin word means to rise up. So if the government, how could they wouldn't rise up because they're already at the pinnacle of that. They would have to bend down. So no, the government is not the insurgent. The government the insurgents are the population, the strategic terrain in an insurgency. There's things that we know that we don't know, and there's things that we don't know that we don't know. I'm not going to go into that because I've covered that ground numerous previous times. But when we were talking about Lawrence of Arabia, that it kind of laid out how the Arabs had attacked Mecca and Medina, and they were beat back out of Medina, and, no, Mecca, yes, the one further north, okay, exactly, and then the laid siege, and the concept around how it was, they could rally their troops and root the Turks out, but that wouldn't do good because either they would be captured as POWs and had to be taken to Egypt where they'd have to supply tents and clothes and food and guards. And if they attacked them, they could fall back to Syria and they'd still be a big problem. So as long as the Turks wanted to stay where they are, Lawrence was more than happy to let them be there, because then they didn't have to care for them and feed them and water them. And then Lawrence got real sick with dysentery and boils from riding hundreds and hundreds of miles on a camel. I'm not going to tell you where he got his boils at, but they certainly aren't on the palms of his hands. That he had about 10 days there while he was recuperating and started thinking about the numbers of what they had. And he, when he had attended Oxford, he was studying to be an archaeologist, and he really didn't, you know, study the military aspect in his classwork, but because they had an extensive library, that in his spare time, he had studied quite a bit about Jomini, Clausewitz, Folk, and a lot of the other military philosophers, strategists, the writers of the books on what it was. And he took a little piece from here and a little piece from there and said, well, these things don't work over here and these things did work over there. But then he came to the conclusion that their insurgency was different because it wasn't the example that we have to go crush the other people's military, that it was easier. So he came up with the algebraic and the metaphysical weapons on how big the area was, how many people they had, what the opposing forces had, and divided it down to this, the Turks wanted to take over this 100,000 square miles and how many outposts that they would have and how many people it would take to man those outposts, and they simply didn't have it. And he also hadn't been named at the time, but at least maybe it's become more popular now, but it was clearly identified back during the Vietnam War of the term now that's in general use. It's called the center of gravity on what is the important thing to the opposing force. And Lawrence realized that the army personnel in the Turkish army were not very important to the Turks. They just recruit more people, press them into, kidnap them into the military. So attacking the personnel was not their center of gravity, but their material was their locomotives, and especially because they couldn't replace those as fast as they could the individual soldier. And initially, because they had planned the Turks and the Germans, and they were going to have a railroad that was called, referred to as the Berlin to Baghdad Railway, and they were certainly working on that previous to World War I, when Lawrence encountered the German engineers and the railroad workers, and where they were at the dig in Karmakesh, modern-day Syria, and along trying to build up the railroad bed to cross the Euphrates River to have that extension going on to Baghdad. But then there was another branch of it that was going to go south along the Hejaz and eventually ending up in Yemen, the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. And so they had already stockpiled enough rail to construct that all the way. So initially, when they started blowing up the railroad lines, it was relatively easy for the Turks, because they had great quantities of stockpiles of the rail, to repair the line. But after a while, and then the idea came upon, and instead of just blowing up the railroad lines, to either put landmines, pressure sensitive, underneath it, so they could go in, dig out the ballast, place the explosives underneath the rails, and then leave a pressure detonator, so when the locomotive went over, then that would close the circuit, and not only would you blow up the railroad line, and then you would also blow up the locomotive. And there were a couple of times where they had used a detonator box where somebody had to sit there, but those things didn't always work. They were extremely heavy, the cables that had to be used, and it was quite, anyway. So Lawrence come up with this concept on doing the mathematics or the whole philosophy behind the war on the numbers that the Turks had, their center of gravity. It's quite an interesting read, because back then, as you recall, airplanes were quite new, just been invented. The internal combustion engine had just been invented. And there were still even armies in Europe that were still on horseback. Even in World War II, most of the German military equipment was pulled still by horses. Anyway, so it's an interesting. So Lawrence came to the reasoning that it showed him that the idea of assaulting Medina, or even of starving it quickly into surrender, was not in accord with their best strategy, because they wanted the enemy to stay in Medina and in every other harmless place in largest numbers, because the factor of food would eventually confine him to the rails. But he was welcome to the Hejaz Railway and the Transjordan Railway and Palestine and Damascus and Aleppo rails for the duration of the war, so that as long as he gave us the other 999,000 of the Arab world. And if he showed a disposition to evacuate too soon as a step of concentrating in the small area with his numbers could dominate effectively, then they would have to try and restore his confidence, not harshly, but by reducing the enterprise against him. So that was the whole deal. They had enough people and enough explosives to blow up the whole railway, but all that would have done was cause them to withdraw. So they just were an irritant, and just blow up a little bit here, blow up a little bit there, and let them give a week or so or a couple of days to repair the railway line. And then let them have another locomotive train come through and resupply the outhouses, the blockhouses along the rail line, because as you recall, at that time they were steam locomotives, and water's not real plentiful out in the desert, so a lot of the water to supply the steam locomotives had to be brought in. And that's another interesting aspect of, because you see, when you expansion and contraction in the locomotive, because it has long flues inside that round part of the locomotive itself. So you have the boiler underneath, and then these long pipes that would run back and forth from front to back, top to bottom, left to right, inside the locomotive, and that had to keep being fired. But because of the expansion and contraction, that the fire couldn't go out. Even if the rail of the train had stopped in one place, you can't just let the fire go out. So the fireman has to continually sit there and feed wood or coal into the locomotive to fire it overnight, because if you didn't, then the contraction of the metal would cause leaks, and then the water would leak out into the fire underneath the flues and put the fire out, and then you'd have to bring somebody in there to weld it all back together to fix the leak. So it had to be continually fired 24 hours a day to keep the pressure up. A little aspect of that you didn't know about steam locomotives. So that was the part of the concept we're going to make it difficult on them, but not impossible. Because their ideal was to keep the railway just working, but only just, with the maximum of loss and discomfort to him, to the Turks. So accordingly, Lawrence put in a few damages to the line, enough to annoy the enemy without making him fear its final destruction, and then rode back to Wedge to explain to the chiefs that the Arab war was geographical, and also to the British, because they didn't quite comprehend what Lawrence's conclusion had come to, and that the Turkish army was basically to the British that it was an accident, not a target, because their aim was to seek its weakest link and bear only on that till time made the mass of it fall. And their largest available resources were the tribesmen, quite unused to formal warfare, and whose assets were movement, endurance, individual intelligence, and knowledge of the country, and courage. So Lawrence really didn't, how should I say this? He studied the Arabs and their tribal raiding, And basically, that's all his operation was. He added technology to it with the use of airplanes, communications, explosives, motor vehicles, armored vehicles, machine guns. But it was still the basic Arab strategy of tribal raiding, hit-and-run operations. He just made it a little bit more modern. So he came to the conclusion that they must impose the longest possible passive defense on the Turks, and this being their most material expensive form of war, attacking the railway, and by extending the Arab front to its maximum, and tactically, that they must develop a highly mobile, highly equipped type of army of the smallest size and use it successfully at distributed points of the Turkish line to make the Turks reinforce their occupying post beyond the economic minimum of 20 men. Once again, he's attacking their center of gravity, making them expose themselves. So, and again, this is the benefit of the insurgent, because the insurgent gets to attack where he wants and when he wants, and the government must guard everywhere, and when you guard everywhere, you go guard nowhere. And if the pressure gets too hard, the insurgent just either goes back to farming his land, burying his rifle, making sure that the government forces doesn't find it, just like what happened in Vietnam, or he can go attack somewhere else. So the idea was it was going to make it impossible for the Turks to reinforce their garrison posts beyond their economic minimum of 20 men. Now, the power of the striking force of the Arabs would not be reckoned merely by its strength, because the ratio between number and area, that determined the character of the war. And by having five times the mobility of the Turks, that they could be on terms with them with one-fifth their number. Now, the Arab success was certain, and it was to be proved by paper and pencil as soon as the proportion of space and number had been learned. And the contest was not physical, but material. And so the battles were a mistake. And all that the Arabs won in battle was the ammunition the enemy fired off, because the Arab victory lay not in battles, but in occupying square miles of the country. And Napoleon had said it was rare to find generals willing to fight battles. The curse of this war was that so few could do anything else. And that Napoleon had spoken in angry reaction against the excessive finesse of the 18th century, where men almost forgot that war gave license to murder. And the British and the Arabs, they had been swinging out on Napoleon's dictum for 100 years, and it was time to go back a bit. Because the battles or impositions on the side which believes itself weaker made unavoidable either by lack of land room or by the need to defend a material property dearer than the lives of the soldiers. And the Arabs had nothing material to lose, so they were to defend nothing and shoot nothing. Another concept. Now, the precious element of the Arab force were the Bedouin irregulars, and not the regulars whose role would only be to occupy the places in which the irregulars had already given access. The Arabs' cards were speed and time, and not hitting power, and these gave the Arabs strategical rather than tactical strength. Once again, if they convinced the Arabs that they were fighting for freedom, and freedom can only be enjoyed by the living. And so the people were precious. They had no need to attack the Turk outposts in force and get mowed down by machine guns. Now, range is more the strategy than force. Now, the invention of bully beef has modified land war more profoundly than the invention of gunpowder. Now, Lawrence's chiefs did not follow all of these statements, but gave him leave to try his hand after his own fashion, because when he came back and told the British in the Hejaz and in Egypt what his concepts were, because they were mainly fixated on the trench warfare. Now, obviously, the ones in Egypt were concentrating on what was going on in Egypt and the Arabian Peninsula. But the overall riding factor back in England was the trench warfare going on in Europe. And as Allenby said, that it's a sideshow of a sideshow, referring to what was going on in Arabia. And I'm not going to go too much into the history of about that and what was going on with Ibn Saud, et cetera, because there was absolutely no information that I can find that Lawrence ever worked or met Ibn Saud. He knew who he was, but there was another British intelligence officer. What was that guy's name? He was the father of the guy that got caught in British intelligence in World War II as a double agent, or maybe it was in the 50s. Yeah, it'll come to me. I ain't going to dwell on it, but you know, I'm sure you've heard of it. So after Lawrence had initially made contact with the Bedu and it helped organize and expand arm and equip them and had an honest appraisal of their probability of its success, then he went back to Egypt and presented his information, and it was kind of contrary to what the people in the offices thought needed to be done, but they were more than willing to at least give Lawrence to let him try doing it in his fashion. So they went off first to Aqaba and took it easily. Then they took Tafil and the Dead Sea, then Azraq and Dara, and finally then to Damascus. And they did this all in successive stages, working out consciously on the sickbed theories. And the process was to set up ladders of tribes, giving them a safe and comfortable route from their sea base at Yenbo, Wedge, and Aqaba, and to their advantages, bases of the operations. And these were sometimes 300 miles away, and that's a long distance in lands without railways or roads, but made short by the assiduous cultivation of the desert power, controlled by camel parties of the desolate and unmapped wilderness, which fills up all the center of Arabia from Mecca to Aleppo and Baghdad. Now, in character, the operations were more like naval warfare than no ordinary land operations in their mobility, because their ubiquity, their independence of bases and communications, and their lack of ground features of the strategic areas and of fixed direction of fixed points. And the quote is, he who commands the sea is at great liberty, and may take as much or as little of the war as he will. and he who commands the desert is equally fortunate. The camel raiding parties, as self-contained as ships, they could cruise without danger along any part of the enemy's land frontier, just out of sight of his posts along the edge of cultivation, and tap or raid into his lines where it seemed fittest or easiest or most profitable, with a sure retreat always behind them into an element which the Turks could not enter. I see we're up at the top of the hour, so we've covered quite a bit of things here today. I talked about Lawrence of Arabia. We talked about the new broadcast. We talked one item about the border news on, this cartel leader just got sentenced up, what was that, 5, 7 life sentences plus 20 years? What are you going to do, wait till he dies and revive him and have another life sentence and do that 7 times? And then we'll bring him back alive and make sure he stays alive for another 20 years? I don't know. Well, it sounds like we're up at the end of today's broadcast. I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'd like to thank you for supporting Liberty Tree Radio. And it's up to you, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be here, but you're going to have to come up. I ain't going to do it.
Have white skin, got a passing eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire sky. A well-dressed man waiting on the last plane. Standing in the gallows with my head in the news. Any minute now, I'm expecting all hell to break loose. Crazy and time is strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. This place ain't doing me any good. Wrong town, should be in Hollywood. Just a second there, I thought I saw something. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts, gonna dress in drag. Only a fool in here thinks he's got anything to prove. Lot of water under the bridge. A lot of other stuff too. Don't get up, gentlemen. I'm only passing.